Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. 2 hours of open forum today. Jimmy Akin, first hour. Tom Nash, second hour. Your calls, welcome. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. I love these Thursday open forums because I know that Sarah's going to play the groovy music at some point. We're going to get lots of great questions. We're going to have lots of fun. And you can get in on it. Just give us a call. 888-318-7884. Whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're a religious person of any sort or not, if you have a question about the Catholic faith, you want to know about God, you want to know about the Bible, you want to know about Jesus and the sacraments, whatever it is, you are welcome to call. 888-318-7884. And one other category that you can call and ask about when Jimmy is here, and that is everything else. You got a question about anything, you want to talk to Jimmy about it, 888-318-7884. Jimmy, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cy Kellett, host of Catholic Answers Live.
It's awful nice to see you. What's dropping tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
So last week we did a true crime story. We don't do a lot of true crime on Mysterious World, but we did cover the 2002 DC Beltway snipers, which was a terrifying event that went on for 3 weeks back in late 2002. And it terrified people all over the country. I remember people here in California were being afraid, even though it was really confined to a small area around Washington, D.C. And law enforcement was able to catch the D.C. Beltway snipers. They were brought to justice. You can hear last week's episode to hear the story of how that happened. And even though the public knew a lot about, at least afterwards, they knew a lot about how the Beltway snipers were caught, there was a completely different side to this story that the public knew nothing about. In fact, if you read books, as I have, about the history of the DC Beltway snipers and how they were caught, the books do not mention this aspect. It is not part of the official history, but it is something that a lot of people would find mind-blowing. And I'm going to be talking tomorrow on Mysterious World to the person who was involved.
And cool.
There is a whole other side to this story that the public didn't know about then and almost overwhelmingly does not know about today. But we're going to be telling about it tomorrow on Mysterious World.
At mysterious.fm, or you can just check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Just put that in your machine. It'll find it for you. Do you find now that you've done hundreds of these episodes and you're popular, you know, you're a popular podcast, it's easier to get these interviews? Like people are more willing or...
The people that I tend to interview, most of them are happy to be interviewed. A few people who I have not interviewed have asked for money, but I don't have the budget to pay anybody. But most of the people I interview are very friendly. They're happy to talk. They're not, you know, they're not looking to make money off of it. And it has helped to be able, at least somewhat, to be able to refer back to previous interviews who are other people who are part of the broad community. I can also send people links to previous interviews I've done and they can see what my interview style is like. I don't do hostile interviews. I also let them see the questions beforehand. Mm-hmm. I kind of have a network of people that I've contacted now who know each other, and so they can talk about things and they can say, so how was Jimmy as an interviewer? And so that helps. I also have had at least one interview that was from a guy who's harder to get and doesn't normally give interviews, but one of his students thought he would make a good guest on the show. And so he talked to this gentleman and he agreed to talk to me and we hit it off and he's been on the show 3 times.
Oh, that's cool. That's very, very cool. Yeah, a lot of people just need to know that they're going to get a fair shake. They don't want to walk into an ambush or something.
Right.
And then there's others that need money. 888-318-7884. If you do get a budget, I just want you to know I'm always available to do interviews.
I'll bear that in mind.
Okay, keep that in mind.
And your expertise on mysterious subjects would be?
Well, no, I'll develop it. If I find out that there's money involved, I will develop that skill. 888-318-7884. We'll start with Joseph right here in California. Joseph, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, Jimmy. Yeah, I don't know if y'all read it, but so my diocese has kind of told me that they want to kind of keep me in my own parish, and due to making people feel uncomfortable and all this stuff. And so I want to know if it's a mortal sin or a venial sin to kind of disobey. It's not anyone in the clergy. The diocese got a lawyer involved and then someone in the department to kind of say, well, look, let's just keep you at your own parish. Hopefully you'll produce some fruit there and people will see it. First of all, I don't know how people are going to see it from afar, but, and we want you to like prove that you're doing good things there. And so I've been kind of attending things anyway. Like, it's kind of hard just to stay in one parish. You know how Catholics are. This isn't like Protestant churches where people just stay in one place. If there's an event or a festival at one parish or some big, I don't know, I went to a men's rosary rally, you know, people are going to like kind of cross, there's a lot of cross pollinating going on between Catholics in the community. It's not realistic. And so is this mortal or venial? I don't think,
well,
I think it hinders my spiritual growth to just keep me in one place. It doesn't help me.
Okay. Well, the first thing I'd say is there isn't necessarily as much cross-pollination as you may think there is. There are lots of people who go to one parish and that's all they do. And they're perfectly happy with that. It can, you know, can help with their spiritual growth. And so I wouldn't feel like there's an urgent need to go to other parishes. In terms of the, and this is something that I think we probably wouldn't want to go deeper into on the air, but in terms of the gravity of violating this, I don't know if it's an instruction or a request or exactly what it is. If it were just a request, well, you could disregard it, and at most it would be probably a venial sin. If it was an instruction, then it could be more serious. And whether it would rise to the level of potentially being a mortal sin, I mean, obviously the three conditions would have to be met. You'd have to have full knowledge of the moral character of the act. It'd have to be a grave act, and you'd have to deliberately consent to it. But as to whether the situation would rise enough that it involved grave matter and thus potentially a mortal sin would depend on the reasons why you were told to stay in your own parish and not go elsewhere. If you were causing grave disruptions elsewhere, then that could provide grave matter. And you could be providing grave disruptions, you know, through no fault of your own. But if grave matter is present, then it would at least hypothetically be able to be a mortal sin. However, my sense is that it would likely be a venial sin in at least in most of the situations that I can think of off the top of my head without knowing further details. Also, if they have some kind of restraining order or injunction under civil law, that would add to the gravity of it, and you'd also be potentially exposing yourself to you'd be creating legal exposure for violating an order like this, and you could potentially face civil legal consequences if the civil courts get involved, or even the even if it's just not criminal court, but a standard civil complaint, you could have potential legal exposure and liability as well. So if you want to have more insight on that, you might want to email Catholic Answers, and you could describe the situation more thoroughly, and we might or might not be able to provide additional guidance.
And I think that we will leave it right there. It's time for a break. We'll take that break. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Thank you for the call. There's one line open right now. If you'd like to get in line to ask your question of Jimmy Akin, 888-318-7884.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN uses the power of radio to reach people whenever and wherever they're searching for answers to questions about their Catholic faith. EWTN Radio is heard on over 500 domestic and international AM and FM radio affiliates. For a complete list of programs and how to hear EWTN Radio, visit EWTN.com and click radio. EWTN, the global Catholic network.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Open Forum. And off to Atlanta, Georgia, we go, where the Mighty Quest radio station is there in Atlanta. Chris in Atlanta, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
How are you doing?
Very well.
I'm dealing with a Protestant who, of course, they think that we worship Mary, which is, of course, wrong. But, and I'm aware of the argument that we only I'm aware that, you know, Jesus called from the cross, behold your mother, then to John, behold your son. And I'm looking for something that I can cut these guys off at the knees with, just to refute their claim that we worship Mary.
Okay.
If you guys can give this.
Yeah, well, I don't generally advise people to commit the criminal offensive mayhem and literally cut off anybody's knees. But I can be of some assistance in a conceptual way. So the thing that we need to do in a situation like this is establish what we mean by the term worship. Because if you don't do that, then you're going to be talking past each other. You need to get on the same page as each other in terms of what the term worship means. Now, it originally meant something different than it currently does. Originally in English, the term worship was a contraction of worth ship. Now, ship, used as a suffix in this way, it refers to a state of being, like kingship is what a king has, and lordship is what a lord has. And so worthship was something that anybody who has worth had. And so to worship someone was to show them respect, to pay them homage, to attest to their worth. And of course, you could attest to worth, you know, to the worth of somebody in all kinds of different ways, depending on what good qualities they have. If you look in the New Testament, there are many passages that talk about the worth of various individuals. You know, for example, the apostles had worth as preachers, and that's why Jesus appointed them as his preachers. Zechariah and Elizabeth are described as being very holy people, and so that's attesting to that form of worth. Jesus says that just an ordinary human being is worth many sparrows, so every ordinary human being has worth. God, of course, has the supreme worth, and as a result, what's happened in English is the term worship has become associated today with attesting to God's worth, and so that's how we use the word today in common speech. You will occasionally find archaic uses of the word that could apply it to people other than God. Like, if, and this is more common in the United Kingdom than it is here. In British English, you will have some government officials, for example, who will be referred to as your worship. That's why if you ever watch The Empire Strikes Back, Han Solo is referring to Princess Leia as your worship, much to her annoyance. Because she's a government official, she's a princess and a senator, so he can call her your worship using this British form of the term. But we don't really use it that way here in America. Instead, we use worship to just talk about the kind of respect that God is owed, because he is of infinite value. He's a deity. He is the only deity. He is infinite in knowledge and power and goodness, and so he has the supreme worth. and therefore he's worthy of the supreme form of worship. So, simple way to talk to your friends about this after establishing that, you know, the word worship means the kind of respect that is owed to God is to say, well, I don't think Mary's a god. Neither do my other Catholic buddies. She's a finite creature. She's infinitely distant from God, just the way we are. Now, she has some special blessings, but if you look on the finite versus infinite set of categories, she's on the finite side with us. And so she is not a god. And since worship is attesting to the infinite worth of God, that ain't what we're giving Mary. So we're just not worshiping her. You may think we are, and you may have been told that we are as part of your, you know, Protestant preaching tradition, but it's simply factually inaccurate. Mary is not a god, and therefore we are not giving her worship in the modern sense of the term.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
All right.
No problem.
Thank you very, very much. Going from Atlanta up to, this says Ontario, California.
California.
If I go to this and this is Ontario, Canada, you and I are having a talk, Edgar. All right.
Yeah. It's not, yeah, that wouldn't be up. That would be out to Ontario, California.
All right. Let's see if you are correct, Edgar. Martin in Ontario, California. We're awful glad you're here, Martin. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes. Thank you for having me. I listen to your radio every day, and I really enjoy your what's keeping you from being a Catholic and everything you guys do. And I just thank you for that last question on the Virgin Mary. That was great. But I've been a Catholic for, you know, since I've been alive. I'm 58 years of age. And I got a brother and a sister that, you know, go to Christian church. And, you know, I decided to go with them a few times. And, you know, to be honest with you, I really enjoy the way they break down the Bible here and there. But I have questions. I mean, is it good for me to be attending these Christian churches, or does it do harm for me? I go because I love the worship. I do love the worship, but there's no gospel. And then I didn't see Eucharist, but last night there was Eucharist, and it was a little weird to me. You know, I mean, there was no priest consecrating the gift, and then they called it juice, and I don't know. It was just a little weird to me. So I didn't even know is it hurting me to be going?
Okay, so it is permitted for Catholics to, as long as they're fulfilling their Sunday obligations by going to Mass, it is permitted for Catholics to attend a Protestant service because they are brothers and sisters in Christ. However, it's okay to go, you know, once in a while to satisfy your curiosity or to learn about another Christian tradition or things like that. But in terms of going on a regular basis, there usually needs to be a reason for that. Some people do have reasons to attend on Protestant services on a regular basis. For example, if they're married to someone who's Protestant, they could, you know, fulfill their Sunday obligation, but still go to the Protestant service as well on the weekend as a way of helping maintain peace in the family. And so there's a special reason they would have for going to a Protestant service. One could go because one enjoys it, but there are some dangers that are associated with it, because even though our Protestant friends are brothers in Christ, they're separated brothers, and that separation is for a reason, and it has consequences. They reject various Catholic teachings. And so if you go to a Protestant service on a regular basis, you're going to be exposing yourself to ideas that contradict the Catholic faith. And that means if you were to go into such a situation, you would need to be able to do two things. The first thing that you would need to be able to do is know your Catholic faith really well, because you need to be able to identify when something you're being taught in a Protestant church contradicts the Catholic faith. So you'd need to know your Catholic faith really well. And the second thing you'd need to do is you'd need to be able to exercise critical thinking. You'd need to be alert to what you're being told in the Protestant service, because they're going to have some, you know, hymns and some sermons and some Bible studies and some prayers that are going to contain elements that unfortunately contradict the Catholic faith. And you're going to need to be using critical thinking to spot those and not just embrace them. So there is the possibility of going, but it does entail dangers. One of the things that you mentioned that it sounds like you've already encountered is it sounds like the particular Protestant church you're going to has a low view of the Eucharist. They don't believe in the real presence. They're calling it juice and so forth. They didn't have the consecration, I think you said. And we're, as Catholics, we're only allowed to receive the sacraments in the Catholic Church or in other churches where the sacraments are valid, like in the Eastern Orthodox Church. But we're not allowed to receive the sacraments in a Protestant context because, unfortunately, they don't have a valid priesthood, and so they can't validly perform sacraments like the Eucharist. And you would need to know that and refrain from going to communion or any other sacramental rite, you know, anything else that corresponds to one of the Catholic sacraments. So it's not impossible that you could go on a regular basis, but it does entail risks. And in order to avoid those risks, you need to learn your Catholic faith really well, and you need to exercise critical thinking at all times. And if those two things aren't the case, then I would say it's better not to go on a regular basis. You might still go once in a while to visit with your brother and sister or something like that, but I wouldn't suggest going on a regular basis because of the risks involved.
That makes a lot of sense. You cleared up a lot of my questions. And yeah, I see that happening now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they didn't welcome me. There was one guy that said, oh, I'm Catholic. Oh, too bad for you. And I really wanted to say, too bad for you. You're not getting the host every day like I do. But, you know, I'm not there to fight with anybody. I was just there to see different views, I guess, on how they, you know, the worship is great. Don't get me wrong. The music, worshiping God, that's where I take it. But, yeah, there's other things that I don't want. Like I said, I don't want to get myself in any trouble. I love my faith. I'm strong in my faith. And, you know, I try to express it. But sometimes people are, you know, different meanings in different ways. Like they'll say, why do you pray to saints? Why this? Why that? You know, and I do defend my faith, but as you said, I'm not, I don't know my Catholic faith well enough to argue. And you know, and you don't argue religion.
No.
Yeah. Also, I would mention, since you mentioned you found the worship style they use appealing, there are different Catholic churches and Catholic worship services that use different styles. I mean, you know, there are charismatic Catholic churches that have a worship style very similar to Protestant charismatic churches, but that also have the Eucharist and the Catholic understanding of things. So you might explore around a little bit and see if you find other local Catholic churches that have the kind of worship that you find appealing.
Martin, God bless you. Thank you so much for the call. I'd like to send you a little book that Jimmy wrote. It's called The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. I think you'll enjoy the book. If you'd like it, please just hang on the line and Edgar will get your address and we'll send it out to Ontario, California. Off to Hayden, Idaho we go, and that means Emma. Hi, old friend Emma. Welcome back.
I got called old lady today.
No, that was not. I wasn't calling you old lady.
No, I know.
Okay, all right.
I know. I have to say hi to Mary. Hi, Mary. She always hears me.
Oh.
So, got a quick question.
Okay, what is it?
Why is it okay to wear a crucifix necklace but not a rosary?
Who told you it's not okay to wear a rosary?
My priest.
Oh, well, that may be your priest's opinion, and you'd have to ask him for the reasons why, but it is not church teaching, nor is it church law. This is just your priest's personal opinion. And I don't see a problem with it. A rosary is a loop of or chain, and a cross is going to be suspended on a loop or chain, and rosaries have crosses on them. So what does it matter if it also has some beads on them? And the physical object can go around your neck. If you want to wear it, that's fine. There are certain contexts where I wouldn't wear it because If you're in certain urban environments, it can be a sign that you're a member of a particular gang and you wouldn't want to be confused as a gang member. But that doesn't apply in most circumstances. In most circumstances, if you want to wear a rosary, that's perfectly fine. There's no church law against that. There's no church teaching against that. If that fosters your personal devotion and closeness to Mary, then I'd say go ahead and do it. Although you should be aware that, you know, at least some people, like your friend the priest, may not approve of it, but you know, you can't be a slave to what everybody else does or doesn't approve of, because you'd be torn into about a bazillion directions. And so you can't satisfy everybody. So do what you think is best in the circumstance, and I wouldn't worry about it beyond that.
Thanks, young Emma. Appreciate the call. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. If you've got a question, we've got a couple lines open. 888-318-7884. Right back with more open forum on Catholic Answers Live. This year, the Catholic Answers Conference turns its attention to the question of God in an age of unbelief. Join us September 21st through 24th in San Diego for I Believe in God, featuring very special guest Scott Hahn and an all-star lineup of speakers. Spend four fun days with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. Seats are still available, but going fast. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 and register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Thank you, Sarah, for the groovy music. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and it is open forum. You are welcome to call with your question, 888-318-7884. Before I go back to the lines, we're all going to get together and we're going to talk about God, and we're going to talk about how to share God and talk about God in a world that is increasingly without God. And that is what we were doing at, that's what we're going to be doing at the Catholic Answers Annual Conference, September 24th of this year. We'd love it if you'd come. It's 4 days and we have a great time here in Southern California. It's we got a special deal on the hotel. And if you know anything about hotel prices in San Diego, $175 a night is an extraordinary deal. You can find out all about it. Who's going to be there? Jimmy will be there. And all of our apologists will be there. And we'll get great talks and we'll have a great time. We'll do the radio show from there. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com to reserve your spot, book your room, CatholicAnswersConference.com.
I used to do the radio show at the conference. I haven't done that in years.
Well, we're down to one show now. Mm-hmm. So the only people who do it, I'm sure we'll have Scott Hahn and probably Sister Regina Marie Gorman. Usually we get two of the speakers to do it. Because
I see.
Now I'm sad because we only get to do one show. Rich in Troy, New York, watching on YouTube. You are next. Rich, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you, Si. Jimmy, I got told recently that I can forego confession, or if I cannot make confession before the Mass, I can do an act of perfect contrition and still receive the Eucharist. Is that true?
Not without further qualification. So it is true that there are some situations where a person who has been in a state of mortal sin and who has been reconciled with God extra sacramentally through an act of perfect contrition can receive the Eucharist. But it's not as simple as just, oh, I'm back in a state of grace now, so I can receive the Eucharist. In order to be able to do this, one has to have a grave reason for needing to receive the Eucharist right now at this Mass, rather than waiting to go to confession. The classic example of a situation where that condition would apply would be if you have a priest. Let's say he's the only priest in town. He doesn't have another priest he can go to confession to, and he's committed a mortal sin, and he needs to say Mass for the people. Well, if he's going to say Mass as priest, he has to receive communion. And so he would have a grave need because the people have a need for the Mass, and he has a need to receive communion if he says Mass. The thing to do in that situation, according to the church's law, is for him to make an act of perfect contrition with the intent to go to confession as soon as possible, you know, meaning as soon as reasonable, and then he can go ahead and receive once he's back in a state of grace due to the perfect contrition. That's a fairly clear situation, but there can also be situations where a member of the laity has a grave need to receive communion right now at this Mass, and they don't have the opportunity to go to confession first. Whether such a situation would apply in your case, I don't know, but it's not as simple as just being back in a state of grace. You need to both return to a state of grace through an act of perfect contrition with the intent to go to confession as soon as reasonable, and you need to have a grave need to receive communion right now as opposed to at another Mass. For example, a rule of thumb that's sometimes used in this regard is, you know, they don't have Masses every week in some places, and sometimes they have to wait. This is particularly in parts of the world that are remote, and they only have a priest come through, you know, once a month or something. And if you're in a situation like that, if you're going to be deprived of the Eucharist for more than a month, if you don't receive right now, then that's also considered a grave need. And so you could receive in that situation. But if it's as simple as, I'm just going to wait till next week and go to confession before next week's Mass, then that would be the thing to do. I can imagine other scenarios too, like you've got some kind of ogre of a boss who's going to be watching you, and if you don't receive communion, he's going to punish you on the job, you know. But the laity normally aren't in this situation. Normally, laity are able to just, I'm not going to receive this week, and I'll go to confession and receive next week.
Rich, thank you very much. I think I will leave that there because we had lots of folks on the line. We'll go to Portland, Oregon next. Alan is listening on 102.7 FM. Alan, thank you very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, can you guys hear me all right?
Yeah, sure.
All right. So I'm just pulling over here real quick. I'll make sure I can hear my own self. Ty and Jimmy, I got a... On the first caller who called today, there was a little bit of discussion in regards to venial versus mortal sin. And obviously, yeah, for mortal, right, something has to meet the three different statutes there as a rubric. One of those rubrics has, for the past year or two, I've been a Catholic for 7 or 8 years now as an adult convert. But one of those two for the past couple years has been bugging me. And it's the one where... a full knowledge of the matter, and, you know, full knowledge of its seriousness, and just kind of working backwards logically here. Doesn't it stand to reason to say if anyone truly had full knowledge, full as in the entirety of, full knowledge of a sin and its repercussions, mm-hmm. then there's no way they would actually pick it. They would never go through with it because it's just too devastating. The consequences are death and hell. So with that in mind, does anyone ever really have full knowledge of what they're doing?
Okay, so there are several dimensions to this question, and I'm just trying to sort out the one to proceed with first. It's certainly true that sin is stupid, and so consequently, nobody who's functioning as an intelligent moral agent should be committing sin because it doesn't live up to the hype. You're going to be happier if you don't sin than if you do. And so just on the level of self-interest, even apart from considerations like offending God, you're going to be better off if you don't sin. And so that can lead one to want to make the kind of argument that you're making and say, well, therefore, there must be a defect of knowledge in the case of everybody and who commits a sin. And you could propose that, but it seems that there are creatures who are much more intelligent than us that also sinned, namely angels. And they were staring God face to face, figuratively speaking, in heaven. Their knowledge of sin and its consequences is way greater than ours, and they sin too. Solomon also, similarly, is regarded as the wisest of the Israelite kings. He's the smartest king, and yet he sinned. And so it seems that you can have real serious knowledge of the fact that something is sinful and go ahead and do it anyway. So the use of your will is not dictated by the state of your knowledge. You have free will. You're not a puppet to your knowledge of a situation. You can choose to act against the knowledge that you have. And it seems that you got to say that that's something that humans are capable of based on the examples of supremely wise beings like angels sinning and also supremely wise humans like Solomon sinning. I think part of the situation here is caused by an over-reliance on the term full. The term full, the modifier full, can mean different things. And it seems to me that in mounting the kind of case that you're making, you're relying on an extreme kind of fullness of knowledge that actually goes beyond what anybody ever has in this life. You know, like if I knew everything about the consequences of a sin and everything about the nature of the moral character of an act, that's a kind of knowledge that nobody really has. We don't know all of the consequences of our actions. That's something that John Paul II points out in Veritatis Splendor, his encyclical on moral theology, we may know that, for example, this is a grave sin and I shouldn't commit it, but we don't know all of the repercussions it's going to have because we don't have a God's eye perspective. We can't look at the course of future history and predict exactly what all the negative consequences are going to be for everybody. So we're always making moral decisions based on partial knowledge, and we shouldn't imagine a kind of idealized understanding of what full would mean that would equate it to the kind of knowledge that God has. Instead, I would say that we need to understand the term full in terms of having a clear, settled recognition that a given act is gravely sinful or not. And that's the kind of knowledge, I often gloss it by saying adequate knowledge. But if someone recognizes this action is gravely sinful, and they believe that it is, and then they freely consent to do it anyway, well, then it would be a mortal sin for them. And historically, the church has proceeded along those lines, and the New Testament itself seems to hold people accountable for their actions in when it's grave sin. It seems to recognize, yeah, people can and do commit mortal sin. Now, there have been recent theologians who have questioned the extent to which that's true, and would mount a case similar to yours, but thus far, at least, the church has not shifted to that position, and it still recognizes that ordinary people with ordinary levels of knowledge, as long as they're adult moral agents who have the use of reason, they can and do recognize that certain things are gravely sinful, and they can go ahead and do them anyway. So the case you're making is one that I'm familiar with some people today making, but it has not been what the church has historically recognized as being the case. Instead, the idea of the amount of knowledge you need to have has been understood in a human way that doesn't entail some kind of detailed, penetrating knowledge that nobody ever actually has. If you know that, you know, killing an innocent person is wrong and gravely wrong, and you kill an innocent person anyway, you're responsible for that, and that's very likely a grave sin.
And I am going to leave it there. And just,
I mean, sorry, very likely a mortal sin.
Oh, did you say?
Yeah, it is a grave sin. Yeah.
Alan, thanks very much for the call, but I got to go to the break. We'll take a quick break, get more questions for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, and together with Matthew Bunsen, I co-host Register Radio, where every week we talk to the Register's writers and editors about the news you need to know and offer authentic Catholic insight on the important stories that impact your life. Join us for Register Radio, Saturday at 4 p.m. Eastern and Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern, here on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. The break, Erica and the baby came in. It's nice to see Erica and the baby. Erica used to be, what's it called? Events. Yeah, events coordinator. Well, you did every job here, but eventually events coordinator. But now she's home and mom. Let's see who we got here. We just did Alan. Nancy in Pennsylvania listening on Holy Family Radio. Nancy, thanks for calling. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah. Hi. My question is about praying. I was taught as a young girl, you know, pray the rosary, the Hail Mary, Our Father. Then I was taught praying as a dialogue with God. Then I taught, no, you pray with intention and for what you want. Then I heard, no, you don't pray it that way. You pray knowing that God wants you to have a goodness and fullness in your life. And at this point, I honestly am confused about how to even pray.
Okay. Well, so the term pray in contemporary English refers to a bunch of different things. And all of the things you just named are aspects of prayer and forms of prayer. There are additional ones that you didn't mention, like praise. You know, you don't have to be asking for something of God. You can just be experiencing, you know, how great God is in your heart and telling God about it. That's what a lot of the Psalms do. On the other hand, there are other psalms that are very much focused on things people need, like protection or forgiveness or things like that. But there are a lot of psalms that just celebrate God and how wonderful he is. And all of those are part of prayer. Now, prayer can take nonverbal forms. The broadest definition that I'm aware of, which is in the Catechism of prayer, is a lifting of the heart and mind to God, and that can happen with or without the use of words. But as it's classically understood, or most commonly understood, prayer involves talking to God, or in the church doesn't really use the term praying to the saints, but in English we do. So it could also be talking to, you know, to God's saints or something like that. But normally the term is most classically used for talking to God, but you can apply it more broadly than that. And when you do that, you can use a pre-written prayer like the Lord's Prayer, for example. I mean, Jesus gave that to his disciples so they could memorize it and say it in the future. So you can use a pre-written prayer. That's also what the Psalms are. Those are hymn lyrics, and they're all prayers to God. So those are pre-written prayers as well. You also can speak to God extemporaneously and just say, you know, Father, this is what's on my heart, and I would appreciate your help with it. And all of those things are just fine. You can pray out loud. You can pray in your mind. You can pray in a kind of symbolic way using an object. That's why people go to church to light candles. The candle represents, you know, if you were able to stay in the church and pray, but you're not, the candle represents you, your prayer to God. Similarly, burning incense in a religious context anyway represents, you know, our prayers ascending to God, and that's kind of a physically enacted form of prayer, therefore. But there's lots of different ways of praying, and I would say, you know, just experiment with them. Don't stress about it. Do what's comfortable for you. And if you want, you could also read the final section of the Catechism. It's also the shortest section of the Catechism, but it deals with the nature of prayer, and that might give you some ideas and further guidance.
And because we're getting near the end, I will leave that there. Thank you very, very much for the call, Nancy. Right now, we will head off to, let me just see where we're heading off to. We will head off to, I'm going to say, Wayne in Orlando, Florida, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Wayne, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. A little context to my question. I grew up in the Protestant church, and my wife is Catholic, and we've been married for about 8 years now, and we both support each other, and we go to both services on Sunday and are active in our churches.
And good for you.
You know, thank you. And we both attend Bible studies and that sort of thing in the other church. So the context to my question is, in the Protestant church, we go and we hear them talk negatively about the Catholic church. And I go to the Catholic church and they talk a little negatively about the Protestant church. And sometimes almost with some disdain in their voice. And it's so, and I feel like sometimes Christ would really be disappointed with the way our brothers talk about each other. So
agreed.
My question is, I guess my question is, with a lot of the time and energy we spend in trying to, I'll call it sheep swapping, would we be better off for the kingdom if we tried reaching those who have no relationship at all with the Lord, as opposed to beating each other up?
Well, we shouldn't be beating each other up, but in terms of sharing our understanding of the gospel with other Christians, I would say we need to do both. We need to do our best to both reach those who have not yet embraced the gospel, and we need to do our best to share what we believe is an accurate understanding of the gospel with each other, because it is a it's a bad thing if we, you know, have some misunderstanding of the gospel. We want to understand, you know, Christ's teaching accurately, and that's why he gave us his teachings, is so we could understand them. And we obviously understand them differently, and we can't both be right, and that applies across the board to the different Christian communities. So it's reasonable for the communities to have dialogue about, you know, what's the right understanding of Jesus's teachings. And we also need to share those teachings with people who've never heard them. So I would say we need to do both. In the course of inter-Christian dialogue, though, we do not want to be beating each other up. We want to be kind and charitable. And, you know, there are multiple reasons for that. Jesus said we need to love our neighbor as ourselves. And so so we need to be loving towards our brother Christians. Also, just for practical reasons, as Mom said, you catch more flies with honey than vinegar. And you're going to be more successful if you are kind and winsome, meaning, you know, you have a, you're communicating in a way that's winning to people, than if you're being a jerk to them. So I, if you notice, I try on this program, for example, always to be respectful of people in the Protestant community. I don't always agree with them because I'm not Protestant, but, you know, like earlier in the show, I was talking about a gentleman or to a gentleman who had been attending a Protestant church, and he was concerned about some of the things he was seeing and, you know, had experienced a Protestant version of the Lord's Supper. And I said, regretfully, unfortunately, you know, people in the Protestant community don't have a valid priesthood, and so they don't have a valid Eucharist. And I said that not triumphantly or denigratingly, but sorrowfully. It's a tragedy that in the Protestant community, the priesthood was lost at the time of the Reformation. And so I try to express a Catholic point of view accurately and honestly, but also in a way that's kindly. And I try to have a generosity of spirit towards people of other viewpoints, including our Protestant friends. And because as I said, and as I made the point to the earlier caller, Protestants are our brothers and sisters in Christ, and that has consequences. And so that would be my approach. I wouldn't do an either or on this. Catholics are known for doing a kind of both and at times. So I wouldn't focus either just on evangelizing or sharing, you know, information with other Christians. I also wouldn't focus exclusively on evangelizing people who are not yet Christians. I want to share the truth with everybody. And so that includes both Christians and non-Christians, and I want to do so in a loving way.
Wayne, I'm going to leave that there and see if I can get another call, at least one here with Jimmy. Christopher in Seattle, Washington, watching on YouTube. If you can be quick with the question, I think we can get you an answer.
Nice, nice. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. I understand that the LDS Church has a practice where a living person is baptized vicariously for a dead person. Mm-hmm. I also understand that the RCC does not affirm this practice, and that
the RCC, you mean
the Roman Catholic?
Okay, the Roman Catholic Church is just part of the Catholic Church. I think you mean the Catholic Church as a whole doesn't have this practice.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. However, if infants. Infants can be baptized and indulgences can be applied to those in purgatory. Mm-hmm. What is the chance that the Catholic Church would adopt this practice in the future?
Very low, because indulgences are a way of helping the dead. And Catholics and Mormons don't disagree on that. We can help the dead. We do it in the Catholic Church based on some principles that are found in the second book of Maccabees, where Judah Maccabee, in order to help the dead, prays for them and also arranges for a sacrifice to be offered for them. And so today, Catholics pray for the dead, and they also have the sacrifice of the Mass offered for the dead. And those principles, indulgences, can be applied to the dead by way of prayer. So that's really a subcase of prayer, because the Church is praying for the dead, and that's how it applies indulgences to them. In terms of baptizing infants, well, it does have the principle that the embedded in it that the infant itself doesn't have conscious personal faith in Christ at this point, and that would be analogous to how in a Mormon context, people who are baptized after they die didn't have faith in life. But what's different is in the case of infant baptism, you're really applying water to the baby itself. And the Catholic Church's understanding has been that you really need to apply the water to the person who's being baptized. Otherwise, you're not really baptizing that person. And so I don't foresee the Catholic Church changing its practice on this in the future.
Thank you for the question. Jimmy, thank you for the hour. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Coming up, Tom Nash. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't called yet, 888 318-784. We'll continue with open forum. Anybody can at all can ask any question they've got on the Catholic faith. More of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.